The Republican National Convention in Cleveland next week promises to be a very dull show. That's H.L. Mencken writing in 1924. In 1968, someone brought a real elephant to the GOP convention in Miami. Norman Mailer wrote, "Interviewing a candidate is about as intimate as catching him on television, so this reporter went to cover the elephant." And until FDR, candidates didn't even go to the conventions. When President Grover Cleveland received a telegram informing him he'd been renominated at the Democratic convention in St. Louis, he said, "Heavens, I'd forgotten all about it." Historian Jill Lepore takes a look at the conventions and much more in a recent piece in The New Yorker. She joins us now. Hi, Jill.
Hey.
So we've got two conventions back to back, like a root canal, you write. And some of the conventional wisdom has been the conventions are boring, that they've been replaced by the primaries since the 60s for excitement. But you say they're not. There are still high and low jinx. Remind us.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit more of the low jinx. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that was so interesting to me in researching the history of the conventions is I had thought of them as rather boring. Like, I remember as a kid kind of watching in the 70s. Oh, yeah, it's just a bunch of guys giving up and giving these long speeches.
Usually guys,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and sort of just, it's televised. It's not very good television, except for sort of the wacky moment of, remember the Clint Eastwood in the empty chair?
Yes, right.
That was gripping television. You're on the edge of your seat. What's going to happen
next? It was
next?
Clint Eastwood talking to a chair. That's when Mitt Romney was being nominated, and he meant to telegraph what, that the chair was?
The chair was Obama.
Oh, yes, right.
So there are these sort of spectacularly kooky moments of the television coverage, but you had a sense that there really wasn't that much at stake, because in the lifetime of most people who are my age, not since 1952 that a convention went past the first ballot. So
yeah,
even when the
us.
Conventions were contested, it was resolved right away.
Right. Remind us what happened then.
Estes Kefauver had won a lot of primaries at a time when not a lot of people competed in the primaries, but he lost at the convention.
To Adlai Stevenson, who I don't think had gone to a primary.
Who hadn't gone to a primary and, you know, was considered by the party ultimately to be unelectable.
Talk a little bit about that, because, I mean, you have so much in this history here, and we'll post it at herenow.org. The entire election process in the U.S. has been wresting power from something else. So the conventions were about wresting power from other nominating processes, because the Constitution really doesn't tell us how to pick a president.
Right. I mean, think about what's just gone on in Britain. They have a new prime minister. How did that happen? Like, that we don't have that system. After the American Revolution, we founded our own government and we had wrote a constitution that said there should be a president. There was a really big debate at the Constitutional Convention. Well, how are we going to choose who the president is going to be? And there was a lot of sentiment in favor of indirect election, that is, say, having the Senate choose the president. So there's this notion at the time that the sort of mass of people couldn't make such a decision. And what emerged was the Electoral College, which is really a compromise with the slave owning South, because this was really striking to me. So as everybody knows, the big compromise of the Constitutional Convention was that slaves would count as 3/5 of a person for purpose of representation, so that the slave owning South could have a lot of representation in Congress.
And that was a compromise. So the North got a little bit, but the North said, hey, you've got a lot of people, but slaves, how can slaves count? They can't even vote.
Right. And this is this huge political dispute, of course, that ultimately ends up resulting in
3/5 of a person.
In the Civil War. Yeah. But that compromise had held the Union together. And so it was imported into this notion of how to elect a president. It would be done by an electoral college. People thought very quickly, because there was also popular voting, well, what are we doing? We're voting for delegates to the electoral college. Are they supposed to vote the way we want them to vote, or are we just voting for them to make a decision on their own? And so there emerged this new system, which is known as the legislative caucus, where the parties got together, members of Congress of the same party, and said, okay, here's who we really want to be our presidential candidate. And then they told delegates to choose that candidate as the party system emerged. Then people said, well, now ordinary people who are voting said, what role do we have in electing the president? Mm-hmm. And now, by the time you get to the 1820s, these are people that weren't used to having a king. And so they said, you know, we don't want this king caucus. We want to elect the president directly, in a sense, at least. And so they came up with this idea in Jacksonian America to hold a convention. Delegates from each state would come. Delegates would represent the electoral numbers of the Electoral College. And they choose a candidate, and it would be this great mass sort of embodiment of the idea of popular sovereignty. The people rule. The people
except
will
that,
decide.
Except that you point out, again, the jinx, high and low. So, for instance, Tennessee, I think, one year decides not to come. So some guy goes out and grabs somebody off a barroom stool and says, you're Tennessee, all 15 delegates.
Yeah, the one guy. Yeah,
and that was called Ruckery, because guy's name was Ruck.
You could Rucker a convention if you'd bring in, you know, a guy off the street to represent a state.
Well, eventually, we started primaries in the early 1900s. When we read this, it's clear. We really have – we continually evolved. And now instead of calls of ruckery, there's calls of rigged, the system being rigged. But the system that was just put in place in the 60s of all these primaries was because people thought it was rigged before that.
Yeah, the trick is you can get a lot of political capital out of saying the system is rigged and needs to be democratized and the people don't have enough of a vote. But you can only say that so many times that at the end of the day, are we just going to sit at our computers and all at the same time instantaneously vote and have a direct election right. of the president or something. But we've kind of got to a point like what is the next level? What is the right. next level of reform?
Right. Put that aside. Thinking of the conventions that are coming up, you talk about how people make deals, and we certainly have seen that. Bernie Sanders got additional seats on the platform committee. Does that really matter? Some people say, oh, the platform committees, they get hammered out. It's usually the losers, you know, the non-nominees who get to put what they want in the platform. For instance, the Republican platform this year is far more conservative than the nominee. Does it really matter?
I think it matters to people within the party who are party loyalists and who want to feel that they've been attended to and heard. It's purely symbolic. But that said, a lot in politics is purely symbolic. It doesn't mean it's really powerful.
Right. I mean, isn't that where some conversations might start, you know, on a platform plank? Gay rights, for instance, I'm thinking, or climate change.
I guess if you were to systematically, it would be a very interesting study, empirical study, to systematically study the relationship between the platforms yeah. and the legislative successes of the party in power in the wake of the election. You see a lot in platforms actually not of advancing an agenda, but of retreating from an agenda. For instance, the Republican Party's commitment to the ERA. Which the Republican Party was the first party to endorse the ERA on its platform in 1940. But in the 70s, the Republican Party, for the first time, abandoned its commitment to equal rights for women. That wasn't a concession. That was a rejection of a whole arm of the party. Yeah. So it's very important. It's meaningful and it's significant historically as an index to the direction of the party. But it doesn't really augur its next successes.
Right. Well, as you say, it's not all a bamboozle. You love these words, shenanigans, bamboozle.
Read Mencken long enough and you're going to call everything flim-flam.
Right. Well, you say it's not all flim-flam, bamboozle, especially not this election. The White House is at stake and more to the State of the Union. The worry this time around isn't that the conventions will be boring. It's that they'll be interesting frightfully. How so?
What I'm alluding to there is just this pervasive sense of foreboding about the possibility of violence. On the other hand, the upside would be, as a historian, as someone who cares about the past and cares about American civics and the democratic institutions that provide stability to the United States and serve as a model for other nations, people really know a lot about the nominating conventions this year. I mean, mm-hmm. there's really been a kind of a lot of conversation. What is a superdelegate? I mean, that doesn't – to some degree, that happens every 4 years when people who aren't winning the nomination begin noticing that the system – suddenly, they didn't notice it
right.
3 years after the last nominating convention. They only notice it 4 years afterward. That's really good. It's useful for people to sit up, have their ears perk up and say, how does the system work? And not in a kind of paranoid, hysterical way, but to wonder what – are the set of circumstances that led us to where we are? And is there room for reform? What is the role of money in these campaigns and in this system? Those are really urgent questions.
Yeah. So we might hear some of those voices raised. As you said, delegates are you know, they have to take pledges. They have to vote as their state aligns them before they're freed if there's more than one ballot. Do you see anything like attempts in the past? I mean, I can't imagine at this late date, but, you know, Ronald Reagan tried to take the nomination away from Gerald Ford. He couldn't the first time around. I mean, Ted Kennedy tried to take it away from Jimmy Carter. He couldn't.
Yeah.
Do you see anything like that?
Before 1968, the real political contest took place within the halls of the convention. People argued about the platform. They argued about the candidates, and there was a real fight. You know, will you swap? I'll give my support to your guy. I'll promise this guy could be Secretary of State if this guy, you know. Mm. And since 68, the real contest has been outside the hall because what goes on in the hall has been scripted and scripted for television and overdetermined. And so to the degree that there is a possibility of a really surprising move, I think it comes from outside the hall. And that's unfortunate because the parties should be able to accommodate division within the parties within a free and full discussion, an open and public discussion. And maybe that is the one happy outcome to imagine as a possibility for these, I think, quite troubling conventions. What's tricky in terms of the television coverage and even the radio coverage, the people who generally go and who they are as delegates, they have signed on to the system, right? So if you're really only talking to the people who are there, they're not necessarily the people who are going to offer the searing and important critique that might offer up a different vision for how to do things. Mm. Those people may well be outside the hall, but those people are more likely to not be there at all.
Jill Lepore, staff writer for The New Yorker, professor of history at Harvard. We'll link you to her piece on conventions, including a really deep, wonderful history at hereandnow.org. And Jill, see you in Cleveland.
Yeah, see you there.
Okay.